Judiciary Committee to order Wednesday, March 2nd, 2011. We're going to open a informational hearing on House Bill 2863. Staff, could you read us what this bill is about?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and committee members. House Bill 2863 expands the definition of place of public accommodation to include places owned or maintained by a public body and services provided by a public body.
Mr. Chair,
it's the first time I've seen Johnson here. I just want everyone to know he's the son of a former Brian Johnson, God rest his soul, our good friend and former colleague here in the legislature, and I just want to welcome my good friend Drewski here.
Yeah.
Let's have Barbara Varkin come up, please.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I'm Brad Avaki, Commissioner of the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. I want to thank you for providing a hearing today on House Bill 2863. I want to give you just a little bit of background on what brought us to have the bill brought forward, and then I think some other folks will want to testify on the bill as well. When you step outside the House chamber, you see hanging on the marble walls right outside the chamber a picture of then State Representative Mark Hatfield with a group of advocates with a bill in his hand. That was the 1953 Public Accommodations Bill, one of the first and best of its kind civil rights bills in the country, a bill that protected people from discrimination in all forms, in all public places. And I must note, passed a full 11 years before Congress acted with Title VII. Oregon was a real leader at the time. That bill charged the Bureau of Labor and Industries with enforcing public accommodations laws, keeping people free from discrimination in all public places, and we've enjoyed that since the time. The difficulty is this, is what brings the bill forward. There's a Supreme Court case, Schwenk versus Boy Scouts of America from the 1970s, that implies that that bill might only apply to places of a commercial interest, meaning that the Bureau would only be able to enforce it against businesses or other places that can show some type of commercial interest, would then exclude any type of discrimination that occurs in any other public place. The difficulty that poses on the enforcement side is that when we have incidents that occur in public places that prevent the public from enjoying a park or a sidewalk or some other gathering place, the Bureau may not have the ability to use this law in enforcement because of that one Supreme Court decision. It becomes very important with situations like we had in Portland a little over a year ago, where somebody had been in a bar in Portland, had exited the bar, come onto the sidewalk where three skinheads were waiting for him and shot him down on the sidewalk, a public place. We currently have, that we know of, eight hate groups operating within our borders. I'm talking about the Ku Klux Klan, the Aryan Nations, Volksfront, the skinheads, and others. Some of them are very loosely organized thugs. Some of them are more organized, funded sometimes by out-of-state organizations, and are receiving information on how to commit these types of acts in our communities. We think it's very important that when one of these groups commits an act in a public place that inhibits the public's ability to enjoy those public places, that we have the ability to prosecute them under the state civil rights laws. What we're concerned about is that one lone Supreme Court case that implies that this only applies to places of commercial interest could hurt us on an appeal if we go after one of these hate groups for committing civil rights violations in public places like this. So the bill before you simply clarifies what we believe the original intent of the law is and what it should be recognized today. as a bill that protects people from discrimination in all public places in the state of Oregon, not just those that have a commercial interest. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Follow up on, you know, we talked about this a little bit along the way. I wonder if we could get a good sense of, a broader sense of what the Bureau would now be enabled to do as opposed to what it's able to do now, and why, you know, you're feeling it's necessary that this particular bill be passed, and why the Bureau would need to have this new, frankly, new power.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I appreciate you asking the question. We don't interpret it necessarily as new power. We actually think that we do have the legal authority to do this now. We're just concerned about expending taxpayer dollars on a case that could get hung up on a Supreme Court decision because of the one decision that we think was erroneous. But let me give you a great example of what we would want to be able to do that we think we would get hung up with now. If the Schwenk versus Boy Scouts of America decision is correct interpretation of the law, it would mean that we would have the ability to prosecute businesses and businesses only, places of a commercial interest, for civil rights violations. In the situation that I just described, where you had an organized hate group, skinheads, that shot down this fella on the sidewalk, and you'll hear other examples of similar activity, what we want the ability to do, free from any decision like the constraint, like the Schwenk decision with those constraints, is we want the ability to prosecute those organizations under the state civil rights laws if we can show that they had an organized effort to intimidate, harass, hurt people based on race, religion, gender, disability, age, sexual orientation, and so on, that we would use the authority of the Post of Labor Commissioner to prosecute them, to attach their bank accounts, to attach their property. If we can show that an out-of-state organization was helping to fund them and further the illegal activity, then we would want to do the same to those groups so that we're able to strangle the flow of money into this state that supports these types of hate groups that we should be rid of. I believe under the current law, we have the authority to do that now. We're just concerned about the one Supreme Court case that we think was wrongly decided, and this bill clarifies that.
Thank you. Could you describe, for an example that you cited, the current sort of set of legal recourses that a victim would have if they're a victim of a hate crime? I mean, what would the government be able right now, federal government even, you know, RICO statute if applicable, and or civil, what are the current recourses that the victim would have?
Mr. Chair, Representative, someone under a situation like I've described, a district attorney could prosecute the people who committed the act under criminal statutes. I think there's the possibility of the United States Attorney General prosecuting under a federal criminal statute. There is the possibility of the individual victim suing in court over the damages that they suffered. All of those are reasonable and viable means of addressing the situation. However, the criminal prosecutions can lock someone up. There are different types of authorities than the Bureau of Labor has, which is to address the damages issue and attach the property and bank accounts and so on. Oftentimes with these types of hate groups, when you prosecute somebody criminally and throw them in jail, it martyrs them. It doesn't necessarily stop the problem in your community. It deals with the one individual. With respect to the private right of action somebody has, they could sue for damages in court. The truth is that when you're dealing with these kind of hate crimes, it is extremely difficult, sometimes financially, and because of the fear and intimidation for individual people to take on a hate group by themselves in court. We have the state civil rights division for a reason, and that's because the state has a legitimate role, always had since 1953 Hatfield Bill was passed, in addressing these kind of concerns in the community. And so what we're asking you for is really not an expansion of authority, just a clarification of it.
Yes.
one follow-up.
Follow-up.
And then, we'll let it alone. The Schwenk decision, I did have an opportunity to read it, and the case, the background was that a little girl wanted to join the Boy Scouts and sued under this statute, which was, from what I gather, written basically the same language from the 1973 amendment, and the court held that partially, I mean, it is vague. It is arguable what exactly they relied on from my just one-time reading of it. But I get where the Bureau is coming from. This is not a safe direction for the Bureau to go without some kind of legislative mandate, especially given the dissent of what was the opinion. Anyway, point is, so a little girl wanted to join the Boy Scouts, and the Boy Scouts were found ultimately to be a distinctly private organization. But the court did rely upon, you know, the fact that this change basically hadn't been made in the law. What I'm getting at is here, we need to be cognizant of unintended consequence. And I'm not saying that if a little girl is adopted by the Boy Scouts, the sky is going to fall and dogs and cats going to be living together in mass hysteria. You know, that's not my point. But we do need to contemplate the broader implications of this, because that would have changed. This change that we're going to be thinking about today would have changed the outcome of that decision, you know, and whatever else may flow from it.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I appreciate you bringing that point up as well. Section 2 in the existing law excludes from our authority places, private clubs, institutions, bona fide clubs that are places of accommodation that are in their nature distinctly private. The amendment we've given you to the current law does not touch that piece of it. We agree that piece should wholly stand. We simply want to clarify that the law applies to places that are both of a commercial interest and not of a commercial interest.
Okay. Representative Fredericks.
How are you? I'm Lou Frederick, State Representative in District 43. I have just a couple of very simple things to say about this. I think most of us already assume that it's already the law of the land, given that we've already talked about in terms of public accommodations. And we've had it here for decades, the Hatfield Law in 1953. Discrimination is discrimination. Equity is equity. And we simply expect equitable treatment in public accommodations, period.
To go along with that, we expect all public accommodations
to be treated equally under the law. And this bill, frankly, clears that up. I have nothing more to say than that. I just wanted to make it clear that's where I was going with this.
Questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Having Stephen Castle, J.L. Wilson, and Midge Purcell. Want to come up?
Good afternoon. I'm slightly more long-winded than Representative Fredericks, but my name is Mitch Purcell, and I'm the Director of Advocacy and Public Policy at the Urban League of Portland, and I'm here to urge you to support HB 2863. The Urban League has been both a direct service and an advocacy organization that advocates for African Americans and others who face inequality and discrimination, and we've been doing so for the last 65 years. As an advocacy organization, we have been engaged in some of the most seminal anti-discrimination battles in the state, including the campaign for the passage of the first Public Accommodations Act in 1953. I believe that there is a photo. I think Commissioner Avakian referred to the photo that used to hang in the halls of the Capitol, which was of the bill signing of the first Public Accommodations Act, which my organization participated in. And that was a time when African Americans were not allowed to eat in many restaurants, sleep in hotels, or use public facilities, or have access to entertainment venues without fear of exclusion or humiliation. In 1961, the then executive director of the Urban League, E. Shelton Hill, who led the organization during the civil rights movement, testified in support of expanding the scope of the original legislation to include ending discrimination in beauty salons, barbershops, and medical services. I'm no E. Shelton Hill, but on behalf of the Urban League, I support this bill because it makes it clear that Oregon's public accommodation law also applies to all places owned, provided for, and maintained by public bodies. Some might ask whether in 2011 this legislation is needed. My organization takes hundreds of calls from African Americans who face discrimination in many aspects of their lives. Our State of Black Oregon report, which some of you may be familiar with, show deep disparities in inequity for African Americans in almost every social and economic indicator. Like many African Americans of my age, I still brace myself before entering some hotels and restaurants. And there are many shops and stores where I have attracted extra scrutiny by security personnel, although I've never had a criminal background, and I think I look fairly benign. But because of the current Public Accommodations Act, I know that I am protected under the law. This bill that we're discussing today needs to make it perfectly clear that the same protection is afforded in our public places such as parks and thoroughfares. These are rights that most take for granted, the right of safety, security, and sense of ease. Just finally, I love hiking and camping in Oregon, and I go frequently. People ask me, why are there so few African Americans that use Oregon's beautiful parks and wilderness areas and forests? I think it's because they are not perceived to be safe places for people of color. This bill reinforces that all Oregonians have the right to be free from discrimination, fear, or intimidation in all public places and accommodations, whether commercial or publicly owned. So I urge you to support the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Krieger, members. For the record, J.L. Wilson, representing Associated Oregon Industries. To Commissioner Avakian's great credit, he walked into the lion's den and talked to a group of mean employers that I represent and are skeptical attorneys, and a litany of employment bills, but 2863 was one of them. And ultimately, we support the bill, and it's important to clarify that employers are already covered under the auspices of the current act, but I think we felt whether somebody was, you know, sitting in a booth in a restaurant or sitting in the park blocks in Portland, it really shouldn't matter, and that the protection should apply equally. It is up to the committee, as Representative Hicks alluded to discuss unintended consequences, and we're cognizant of those. But I did want to be on record that AOI supports.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, Representatives, my name is Stephen Cassell. I am on the board of directors for the Q Center, which is Oregon's only LGBTQ community center, which in large is a gay and lesbian community center. I'm here today to talk to you about some incidences that happened in the Portland area over Memorial Day of last year and why this bill is important to ensure those things do not happen and it puts fear into people before taking the actions against other people. Last year, three of my friends were brutally attacked by skinheads coming out of a bar on Stark Street in Portland, Oregon. This continued to happen throughout the summer with other incidents of people being hit with bottles coming out of bars. Pretty much wherever you can walk in the downtown area, it became a danger zone to be a gay man in Portland in 2011. I'm asking you to help us. I'm asking you to help the state of Oregon. This isn't just a gay issue, but it does affect my community. And I implore you to vote yes on this bill and to move this forward.
Committee, do you have any questions? Okay, thank you.
So we have a bill.
Yes. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2863 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2849. No, excuse me, 2828. Representative Witt.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2028 creates an unlawful employment practice of an employer interrupts employee insurance when employee is scheduled for or attends jury service, creates an unlawful employment practice of employer discharges, threatens to discharge, intimidates or coerces an employee by reason of employee's service or scheduled service as a juror, permits employee to bring civil claim or file a claim with the Bureau of Labor and Industries in either case, adds that a court can assess a civil penalty in the amount of $720 for a violation of the latter unlawful employment process. Practice.
Brad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, co-chairs, member of the committee, State Representative Brad Witt from House District 31, appearing here before you in favor of House Bill 2828. This is a rather simple concept and one that is intended to remove a potential disincentive and in fact, a potential financial hardship for jury service for the individual jurors. Specifically, that hardship comes about with the potential loss of certain kinds of insurance coverage because of their jury service, and that happens as a result of eligibility and how oftentimes employees become qualified to receive this insurance. Typically, if this insurance is offered, and I would use health insurance as an example, employees would be required to work a given number of hours in any month in order to qualify as a minimum threshold for that coverage. In those instances where jury service is of sufficient length to subtract from the minimum number of hours necessary to qualify for that insurance, these folks lose the opportunity for that coverage. This is a very harsh penalty for these folks doing what any of us would hope that they would be doing, which is to serve as a juror when called to service. This bill provides for the continuation of insurance coverages and says that the employer will maintain payments into the insurance plan, and that in those instances where the insurance payment would normally be paid by the employee, that the employer can then recoup those payments after the juror returns to employment. With that said, I believe that this bill needs one very small amendment, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As currently written, I believe that it is it mandates that the employee accept the employer's coverage. Now, that in and of itself is probably not a bad thing in the vast majority of the cases, but in those instances, as a result of accepting that coverage, that the employee would choose not to have his or her wages reduced for that coverage, that is the scenario by which I would offer an amendment. I don't have it drafted here today. Conceptually, on line 8 begins coverage for an employee, and conceptually I would suggest and am going to am in the process of having drafted language that says who elects such coverage. With that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would ask for the opportunity to bring that amendment forward to you and urge your passage of House Bill 2828.
Okay, thank committee you. Members, any questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you for bringing this bill to us. So is this an actual case? This has actually been done. This is not just presenting it to us in the abstract.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, there are actual cases where people have lost insurance coverage as a result of this service, and it is through no fault of their own. It is through no fault of the employer. It's through no fault of insurance companies. It is a matter of how we have traditionally set up insurance coverage and how employees earn that coverage in the workplace setting, and this is one of the I believe, unintended results of the system that we have designed. It needs to be fixed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Brad, in the case where a person ended up being one of these juries at 6 months, 8 months, a long, long trial, can you address how you look at this working for that employer and the employee?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The bill would suggest that with the amendment, upon the employee's election, the employer would continue to maintain that coverage, and at the point that the employee returned to work, if that coverage would have normally been paid by the employer then is entitled to recover those payments from the employee, the returning juror, the employee's wages from that point forward.
Anything further? Guess not, Brad.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
J.L. Wilson, would you come up, please?
Thank you, Chair Krieger and members of the committee. My name is J.L. Wilson, representing Associated Oregon Industries. The jury service issue is a tough one for us in the event that what Representative Witt alluded to, instances where somebody's on grand jury service for 6 or 8 months, it is a real significant issue. Anytime that an unlawful employment action is proposed, obviously I have to introduce some level of skepticism here because that's... we don't like seeing more unlawful employment actions on the books. The issue is, I understand that there's two issues. First of all, I don't know the depth of this problem of folks having their insurance yanked. And so I don't want to dive in and support something where a new unlawful employment action on the books, when I don't know the depth and breadth of this issue and who's having their insurance taken away. As it would work now, I have to work a certain number of hours per week at AOI in order to get health insurance coverage. That is 36 hours at my company. It's across the board. It varies from company to company. I think one of the things being alluded to here is the instance of part-time workers losing health insurance coverage because they are serving on a jury. And maybe they have to work 20, 22 hours a week or something like that. The reality is... an employer could legally get around this requirement just by upping the hours that are required to be worked in order to get health insurance, and we have this new unlawful employment action on the books, but there's a method for employers to legally get around it, which is their legal right to change the terms of their contract with their health insurer and require a new set number of hours to be worked on a weekly basis. So that's kind of the issue that we run into. With regard to Section 3 of the bill, it appears to create a new right, a new unlawful employment action for discharging, threatening to discharge, or intimidating or coercion with regard to jury service. My question there is, what I don't understand, what about current law is not working well to authorize what appears to be new language that authorizes a new unlawful employment action? It seems that those instances are properly covered in statute already. So this is sort of a tough issue. There is a bill before you, House Bill 3034, which gets to the issue of jury service, which AOI was prepared to support, which said that an employer couldn't force somebody to use vacation time or sick leave or personal time in order to do jury service. And, if something like this were to pass, I don't know that we could support that bill because that is one avenue that employers can use to mitigate or offset the hours that are lost on jury service. So it's sort of a puzzle here that we put together, and it's just one of those things where I would urge to tread carefully.
Representative Shaw. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chair. J.L., you and Representative Witt.
Through your microphone.
Oh, knock my can over, too. So the DAs have a letter here saying that this happens. I'm interested in finding how much it happens, how much it would cost, and who's going to pay. I mean, the employer will pay, but I just want to know how much. And if it isn't happening a lot, then I don't know. If it isn't having a major impact on business, then I would actually be more sympathetic to it than if it's happening all the time and it creates a burden. So I'd like to find out what's going on here. I will say our jury system... it's woefully underfunded, And it was like everything else around here, but it's difficult to get people to attend and just give them one more reason to say I have a hardship. But I do want to find out more. How deep of a problem is this? Is it happening all over? Is it just have a few times? I don't know.
Thank you. Chair Krieger and Representative Schaffler, I think that was my initial point. I don't personally have a grasp on the depth of the issue, and I would just like to know.
JL, could you address the issue? You got an employer who's got under 10 employees, 3 or 4, and if he's paying insurance for that person, the effect that would have on a small person compared to Boeing, for instance, they got tens of thousands of people, and that becomes just hardly pennies when you look at it. There's got to be a difference in my mind on the effect it's going to have on that business and their ability to do it.
Sure. Obviously, for a smaller employer, you're dealing with other issues other than just the insurance. The actual physical job that needs to be filled in a 3 or 4-person shop is distinctly different than somebody in a much larger organization. I would presume that with a company like Boeing, something like this would be collectively bargained anyway, so I'm not sure it's an issue with the bigger companies that have a unionized workforce. But, you know, those are just thoughts. Educated guesses.
Okay. Committee, got anything else, Tom?
Mr. Chair, I'm concerned, even if it is a small company, and I don't imagine this happens a lot, but I worry about a family not having any insurance and then some disaster strikes while the husband or wife is on jury duty. Then you have a family that's bankrupt, and then we're all, you and us, are all paying then through social services to try and protect those people. And I am interested, as the others are, in the number of this that this goes on. But I really think somebody who answers a call to jury duty, which we require them to do, it isn't like you feel like it or not, you're really ordered to go. I know a lot of people get out of it. I know the jokes about you don't ever want to risk your life in front of 12 people too dumb to get out of jury duty. But the people really are answering the public call on that, and we're asking them to do that, ordering them to do that. And I don't want them to lose health care, as you, I'm sure you don't either. I don't want them losing health care for answering the call to public service. So that was just kind of my...
Sure. Reverend Nolan.
Thank you. It is a bit of a conundrum, because if it's a widespread practice, then we need to do something in order to raise the respect and cooperation that people have with jury duty. I've served on 2 different juries, both of them 2 days duration. I haven't been on any jury that lasted 3 weeks or 2 months, which I can understand is a huge burden. In my county, and I think in most counties, local jury duty is a day of commitment unless you happen to be impaneled on a jury that lasts longer than that, and more than 2 days is a very unusual jury service. So if it's a widespread issue, I think we really need this bill. If it isn't widespread, but it does happen, as Representative Witt pointed out, then it shouldn't be a burden for your members. Without knowing that, it's hard to weigh in, but I would weigh in on the side of making it easier and more respectful for people to fulfill their civic duty of being on a jury.
Representative Schaffler.
Chair, I've been called to jury 4 times, twice in Iowa, twice in Oregon, and every time I got off because it was going to create a financial burden because I had to go to work. I guess my question for the lawyers is, you know, can you, and would this be an emergency underneath the bill we heard the other day, can you now say, look, I'd love to go, but if I'm not at work, I'm going to lose my insurance coverage. So, judge, please let me off. I would like to hear an answer to that question, too. And if that's the case, then we have to make sure every worker knows that and doesn't get wound up in this. But I don't know the answer to that question.
Thank you. I guess as state legislators, it's incumbent on us to encourage people and enable people to serve on a jury. So I think if this happens to one person, it's reason enough for us to pass this legislation.
Mr. Is that Wong?
I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Kocher. I appreciated Representative Nolan's comments because, you know, the one-day jury service, which is the standard that presiding judge Dale Kosh installed in Multnomah County, really makes a big difference on these types of things. You serve for one day, so you don't have to worry about these instances where you haven't worked enough hours that week or whatever it is. You're available that day to meet all the constitutional requirements for a proper cross-section of the community and all of those things right to a jury trial. And then if you're not impaneled on a jury, you're done, and you're done for 2 years. Now, I don't know how that would work out in a county with far smaller population, but I do think that a lot of these issues can be resolved with a change like that that doesn't involve us worrying about creating a new litigation trap for every, you know, for our small businesses in particular. And it still promotes jury service as well, which is what Representative Tomei is concerned about, and I am as well. But if we can avoid, you know, creating other burdens, it's probably best.
Representative.
Thank you. I have to correct the record here. I got off for a financial burden in Iowa twice. In Clackamas County, both times, we were in session, and they let me off. In case Judge Maurer's walking, watching, I don't want to get any trouble for why I got out of jury duty.
What wages you're making here, Representative, it would be a problem, right? If they docked you.
Mr. Chair, just the one other thing while we're talking about this, if it is a small somebody that works part-time, they're even more vulnerable to losing the hours that might qualify them. And so I don't want anybody suffering for other than you already suffer for financially most of the time for jury duty since it pays $5 a day. But I think this is a small enough issue, and we need to look into that. But I think that the law would be a good law to pass. It will have such a minimal effect, but it will protect some of the most vulnerable people. Because somebody, like if you were in a law firm or a bigger law firm, you could probably pay out of your own pocket if you had to. If you're working minimum wage part time, you can't. So that's the people we really need to worry about here. Thank you,
Representative Schaffer.
I'm not working for AOI, but I want to say this. We're asking these businesses to pick up a tab that for something that we all benefit from. That's what we're doing here, and I just want to put it on the record. I'm not saying we shouldn't, but that's what we're asking of them.
Yeah. I think that burden is going to vary a lot depending on how often it happens to hit a business or the size of the business and whether they have to replace that employee with someone with their existing one's gone. Mm. Representative Wong?
No, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I agree. Conceptually with Co-Chair Barker that, you know, this is something that we need to look into. The one question I have that hasn't been answered, though, is I'd like us to take a look at what existing protections are there under other areas of the law that protect people who want to serve as jurors from, you know, being harmed in their job. And I think we need to review those as well as part of this conversation to make sure that this is something that is, you know, I don't want to be duplicative, I guess, is my point. I mean, if we got it covered and it's an enforcement issue, then we need to deal with the enforcement issue. If it's not covered under the law and they don't have the tools necessary, then yes, we need to look at this to make sure we have the tools necessary to promote jury service.
Representative Witt, can you come back up a minute, please? Do you know, Brad, whether anyone has actually researched to see if there are other mechanisms already in place that we might work with, or is this the only thing you've been able to see or find?
Mr. Chairman, again, Brad Witt, House District 31. Tried myself to find data on this because I anticipated this set of questions, and I was unable to come up with any figures other than anecdotal memories, frankly, of what has occurred. And I will tell you that in 30 years as a union representative, I have come up against this situation about a half a dozen times. In each of the cases that it comes up in, it comes up because the consequences, the reason why we are made aware of it is because there's a tragic outcome as a result. And one instance was a young girl who needed medical care, and the insurance, the health insurance, was lost because the parent didn't qualify for the coverage. And so these are very, as I say, tragic instances. They don't come up very often, but I put the legislation forward to try and address these situations, which are a rarity. But when they do arise, I can tell you that they're oftentimes gut-wrenching outcomes, and with a rather de minimis number of cases, and the opportunity for the employer to recover any portion of the outlay that would typically be borne by the employee, I tried as best I could to make this an application that would prevent some tragic consequences and be of very minimal impact on our employer community.
Okay, anything? Okay, thank you. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on 2828 and open a hearing on 2849.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2849 increases the penalty for a crime of criminal mistreatment in the first degree to a Class B felony if the victim is 65 years of age or older.
Dennis Carlson.
She was ill, so I have some testimony that she had written and handed out. Chairman Barker?
Can you identify yourself, please, real quick, and then go ahead.
I was just going to do that. Chairman Barker, Krieger, and members of the committee, my name is Dennis Carlson, and I'm here to ask your support for House Bill 2849. My mother-in-law was an adult care home resident from November 21st, 2005, until November 30th, 2007. My wife and I moved her there following abuse in another care facility. Prior to placing her there, we visited the facility, then checked its records with Clackamas County Adult Care Home Licensing. At that time, the home had perfect record. Okay. However, we did not know the home had problems in Multnomah County prior to it moving to Clackamas County. At that time, care home records does not follow from county to county, and thus the care home had a clean record. Also, the care home's owner told us she was a CNA, which was also on her business card. At first, my mother-in-law's care appeared to be very good, and then it started to deteriorate. On a visit to her oncologist, the doctor discovered that her cancerous breast had been severely palpitated and bruised, and he issued a stern warning to the caregiver never to do that again. Meanwhile, my mother-in-law was put on hospice. During the hospice nurse's visits, the nurse found my mother-in-law's body had numerous bruises all over it in the shape of handprints. The owner caregiver required the hospice nurse to make an appointment before coming to see my mother-in-law, which really sent up some red flags for us. This is never to happen according to adult care home regulations. Hospice is to have patient access 24/7 without having to make an appointment. The owner caregiver was not on site during some of my visits to see my mother-in-law, thus leaving the elderly residents, quote, home alone, unquote. This was reported to Protective Services and it was substantiated. However, there were no sanctions imposed. I also observed the caregiver slamming a resident into a chair, yelling at her, "Eat, eat, eat!" You don't do that. She would also quite often yell at my mother-in-law. The care home's owner caregiver had my wife and I paying $100 a month for incontinence supplies, in addition to having us supply them and also having hospice bring them. My wife and hospice nurse found the supplies stockpiled under my mother-in-law's bed. When this was brought up to the care homeowner's caregiver, she became explosive. It appeared to us that she was trying to extort money and supplies from us. Then she gave me an undated letter asking for an additional $300 a month for feeding and turning my mother-in-law in bed at night. This was not the truth, as my mother-in-law was able to do these things herself. The care homeowner caregiver fired the hospice bath aide, which was something she was not supposed to do. It wasn't in her realm of things. She said she did this because the bath aide backed into her driveway. You figure that out. When my mother-in-law was ordered to have bed bath, she was given a tub bath by the homeowner caregiver. An incident happened in the bathtub where she was severely bruised. One day, my wife went to visit her about 10 a.m. on a Saturday, and the residents had not been given breakfast. The caregiver's excuse was, kind of my day off. Following this, we moved my mother-in-law to a new care home where she became full of smiles and repeated many times, thank you, thank you, thank you. We were so pleased that she was at last in a loving home with wonderful care. This is where she spent the last days of her life. After we moved my mother-in-law to the new care home, we learned that the previous care home owner caregiver was not a CNA. At that time, the Oregon State Board of Nursing did not have a regulation regarding CNA impostors. However, it issued a very strongly worded letter to the CNA impostor. Had we known this person got into trouble, thank you, in Multnomah County and lied about being a CNA, we would have never, ever left my mother-in-law in that home. If we had House Bill 2849, things like this may have been prevented. People in the care home business would know they are going to be dealt with if they abuse our elderly loved ones. They need to be held accountable for their actions. Thank you for considering House Bill 2849.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, Edward McGlone here.
Yes.
Come on up, please.
Mr. Chair, I was not intending on testifying. For the record, my name is Edward McGlone. I work as a legislative aide for Representative Dave Hunt, the sponsor of this legislation.
Okay.
I was not intending to testify on the bill.
All right.
Are there any questions that I can help the committee address?
See, if Dave was here, we could ask him some questions.
Right? Yeah. I apologize. He got pulled away to a couple of meetings during this hearing and was unable to attend.
All right. Let him know we did have the hearing, and co-chair and I'll be looking at probably moving the bill.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2849. Jeff, you want to take over the last part? I'm going to be reading for a little bit. Sure, let's see if I get back. 2704. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2704.
Chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2704. Authorizes the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to certify liquor control agents employed by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, requires such agents to be certified within 18 months of employment absent good cause for extension, makes the crime of assaulting public safety officer and aggravated harassment applicable to such agents, permits any action necessary by DPSST and OLCC before January 1st, 2012 to enable operation according to the terms after January 1st, 2012, declares emergency effective on passage except Section 3 and the amendments to the public safety standards and training statutes. They are effective January 1st, 2012. There is also an amendment pending. It's been requested, has not yet been received, that limits the applicability of the DPSST certification requirement to field agents, those who are conducting on-site inspections, also recognizing currently employed field agents who have already completed the approved training as immediately eligible for certification.
Thank you. I'd like to call Linda Ignowski, Mary Botkin, and Steve Bainbridge, please. Go ahead in any order. Just identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin, and I am the representative for the American Federation of State, County, and
those folks who work at the Oregon
Control Commission at every level, but in this case, we represent the inspectors and the enforcement officers. In getting the bill drafted, I just want to clarify that we only meant to cover those individuals who are actually out in the field doing on-site inspections, and so therefore we need to get the bill changed to reflect that intent. And we will get amendments drafted doing that. Let me just say that one of the frustrations that we are beginning to have is that our inspectors are increasingly put in high-risk environments, and currently they are not trained through DPSST. However, they are trained on the job, and the training that they receive is DPSST certified, though under the statute they are not certified by DPSST. And so we want to clarify that, want to change the way it's done, and want to provide a more professional environment. I think that the person who can best speak to the problems that these folks have is Steve Bainbridge, who's one of our officers, and he is with us today, and I think that I will just keep quiet and answer questions if you have any, and let Steve talk.
Okay, please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Bainbridge. I work as an inspector for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I have been employed in this position, also work out of class regional manager supervising the position for almost 26 years. I wanted to come before you today to ask for your support on House Bill 2704. There are 42 inspectors, and we believe this bill is long overdue, and they all support the bill. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission supports this bill, and this bill corrects certain legal oversights and raises the bar for the men and women who are employed as OLCC inspectors. The fiscal impact on this bill, I believe, will be minimal, although there will be someone who can better address that issue than I. The bill designates OLCC inspectors as public safety officers. And first, let me say public safety officers enjoy certain legal protections. In the event they are assaulted or subjected to harassment, OLCC inspectors are peace officers, and let me explain that, with the authority of a peace officer for the purposes of liquor enforcement. And they're actually covered in a separate statute. They work with police, investigating a variety of criminal activities, yet they do so without the same legal protection, and this bill would correct that problem. A legal protection and designation coupled with good training, it only makes sense. when you understand that inspectors are performing the function of a peace officer, yet don't fall within the public safety statute. They have enforcement and significant regulatory powers, yet they have less training requirements than certified DPSSD security personnel who are private. Yet inspectors have been called upon to cite security personnel into court for failure to have DPSSD certification, and this is but one odd example of why the legislation is needed. Second, this bill ensures a professional level of training provided by the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. The training will be tailored to meet the needs and duties of the position, and I think the board will speak to that. It's not like police, but rather the training will be adjusted to help these people perform their specialized role. And I had an example in mind of like parole and probation, where they do they have training specialized for their role and function. A standard for employment will be set and maintained by this bill. This will serve as a guide for future employee conduct. This bill will allow for enhanced background checks for employability. Enhanced background checks are needed for people who are performing the functions of a peace officer. And let me just say, when I work with the police, in my case with Portland Police, they presume that I've gone through the same program as they have, and that may or may not be the situation. And in summation, this bill sets the stage for meeting today's standards so that all of us as working professionals are covered under the same legal protections, the same training. It really only makes sense. Just to let the board know, I went through the academy in 1985 and the full police academy. It was very good training, very helpful, and it helps me perform my function. I later went through a tailored, customized course through the academy to receive a certificate of completion with them in 2005. And I know one of the issues they stressed was agency liability is reduced when you're trained in this area. Inspectors have the handcuffs and the pepper spray and the baton. But the training, I think, is best handled by the people who are focused on that training. And so I can't emphasize that enough. I can only say that I'm available for any questions that you have of me, and I'd be happy to give you my perspective on that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any questions for Mr. Bainbridge? Linda, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Linda Ignelski. I'm the Regulatory Services Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I'm here today to support House Bill 2704. I'd like to give you a little bit of background of inspectors and where we've been at the commission. Back in the 1970s, all of our inspectors attended the full police academy. And that continued until about 1982. We had an incident in 1982 where one of our inspectors passed away with a heart attack during training. At that time, the commission made a decision to discontinue sending our inspectors to the academy based on this liability, but also there was no requirement for them to send them anyway. This was just a decision by the commission to send them to the police academy based on the decisions back in 1970. It's interesting that in our statutes, ORS 471775, it specifically gives the inspectors, and it does say investigators, the full authority of peace officers in the state of Oregon. However, if you go to the definitions under any of the ORS is a 182s or 162s, you can't find us anywhere. And so we've had this identity crisis for a number of years of who we really are. Even though the statute says we have all the authority of a peace officer, we really can't call ourselves peace officers. And so this has caused some confusion for some DAs and for some judges saying, well, do you have the authority to cite? Our position has always been our inspectors only have the authority to enforce liquor laws. We're not out doing traffic stops, drug activity. Our authority for the commission, since the inspectors only work for the commission, only our inspectors can deal with liquor law enforcements and related laws to that. So this is not an expansion of their authority. This is just to give them, I think what this bill does is three things. It gives them an identity that they are at least a public safety officer that are recognized by statute and by the courts that they do have legal authority. And the other thing, it gives them, as Steve said, additional protection for being assaulted and for aggravated harassment. Over the years, we have seen, and I have seen, a more aggressive patrons and people at licensed premises. And I know most of you probably don't go to some of the more notorious places in Oregon. Maybe there's an exception on the but
looking at you.
But it's interesting that I've had more use of force reports in the last few years than I've ever seen before, and I've been with the commission for 15 and a half years. And I think I want protection for my staff. They're out there unarmed in these places trying to enforce liquor laws and trying to do the best job they can. We want as much protection. If somebody's going to assault them, there's got to be a consequence for that because they are not law enforcement. They are liquor control specialists. So we really encourage this, giving them to identity and giving them the protection, additional protection for assault. The third thing that this does is provide some quality training. Back in 2003, we began working with DPSST. We recognized we wanted some standardized training that was quality training for inspectors that was universal across. So we worked with DPSST on a curriculum. We sent our inspectors, all of them, to 4 weeks down at the academy, and they actually went to, well, first one was in Monmouth, two of them were in Monmouth, and then we had to take a break while they were building the new facility, and then we sent a group to the new facility, and we spent 4 weeks down there doing training. I think there's assurance that, one, we had quality training, although a lot of the training was done specifically by our staff because of the liquor laws, but also it gave our people and a credibility of their training, that it had standardized training and oversaw by DPSST, and I think this is really important. At that time, DPSST did not have a certified program. I mean, like now they have a parole probation program, they have them for corrections, they have them for security, but there wasn't any recognized program training for our people, so all they could give us was a certificate of completion of this 4 week. We would like to standardize that to have it recognized by DPST as a certified program, just like parole and probation corrections that specialize for our inspectors, so they can have the credibility with law enforcement, but also provide the protection. So the commission supports this bill.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm having trouble visualizing how it is that you do this enforcement, and you used a couple of words, protection for assaults. So I'm assuming you don't carry firearms. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That's a follow-up?
Correct.
So could you sort of paint a picture for me how you would deal with assaults, and what would those assaults be like, and where would they happen?
Mr. Chair, Representative, what we are referring to is legal protection, so that in the event of an assault, it's assaulting a public safety officer or aggravated harassment, if the charge were that. For example, let's say an inspector were assaulted in a bar by some patrons. The district attorney might decide in that case to ultimately resolve it with an assault for conviction on the matter versus assaulting a public safety officer, which there are added consequences for that offense. And that's one example.
Follow-up? So how would DPPST, whatever that is, help you with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the board stresses safety and watching for the signs and dangers of being assaulted. By having the training, you could literally see a problem and you could back away from it, secure assistance from the police, and then return to the establishment and address the issue or concern.
Mr. Chair, if I may add to Representative Tomei, also by adding to the definition as public safety officers, that automatically puts in a category that has this increased protection for assault and aggravated harassment. And that's one of the reasons why we'd like them to be in the definition. We're not asking for additional authority.
It enhances the penalty.
Okay, that's what I'm after. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, Representative Schaffner.
In the fine establishments I attend, it's the lottery guy that's in trouble getting it. I guess my question is, you ain't going to come in 2 years from now and want yellow flashing lights on your car, are you? Okay, good.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, thank you, panel.
And Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
To answer the unasked question, they're already in police and fire, so we won't be asking for any enhanced benefits either.
Tom, you're speaker, Lang. You're not signed up, and you want to talk? Or did you want to testify?
No.
Okay, okay. Director Gablitz and Marilyn Lawrence, please.
You're fine.
Whoever wants to go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I manage the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Sections 1 through 3 of House Bill 2704 are the elements of the bill that bring Oregon Liquor Control Commission investigators and inspectors within the jurisdiction of our department. This means that we would have jurisdiction over the minimum standards, training, and certification for these officers. It establishes a new category of DPSST certification for a certified liquor control agent. Our agency, as you have heard, has worked with OLCC in the past to deliver training for their enforcement personnel. That training was primarily developed by OLCC personnel delivered at DPSST using our training staff, particularly in the specialized areas such as law and legal topics or use of force topics. The training was designed to meet needs identified by OLCC, and they reimbursed our agency for the cost of that training. It was a voluntary training arrangement. Under House Bill 2704, the model for determining the content of that training would be different. The bill provides that we are to certify those who are qualified to be liquor control agents. If House Bill 2704 is adopted, our agency will conduct a job task analysis to determine the critical and essential tasks for a liquor control agent. Based on the critical and essential tasks, the minimum standards for employment, training, and certification will be developed. The content, then, of the training that has already been delivered would be reviewed to ensure that all of the critical and essential tasks were addressed in the model that had been developed historically over the last few years. The curriculum would be modified as needed to ensure that all critical and essential tasks were addressed in the basic training. We would also do an assessment to see if a field training manual should be developed. That's the model that we use for all of the other criminal justice disciplines that we regulate to ensure that people who have left the training environment can then go on and perform the required work on the streets at their agencies. Because enforcement of Oregon's liquor control laws is a very specialized subject area, we would work in close partnership with OLCC personnel, both on the job task analysis, the curriculum development, and then particularly using their specialized personnel for delivery of the training that is within their areas of expertise. We understand that amendments that are being discussed would further define the groups of personnel that would be subject to DPSST's minimum standards. Because the number of affected personnel is very limited, it is possible that the basic training could be conducted over time for as few as two or three people at a time in order to fall within the 18-month certification window. That class size might result in a training delivery structure and model that is quite different than the one that we utilize now. As these matters are clarified, we will be able to prepare an estimate for the fiscal impact. But while the amendments are being discussed and the actual numbers of people and structure are unclear, we don't have a clear fiscal impact estimate yet. Thank you.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Eric Skablix. I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, more often known by its acronym DPSST. As been mentioned previously, we have a longstanding relationship with OLCC. We've had very candid discussions with both AFSCME and the commission about what this statute does. The easiest way to explain it, this would be a new family member to DPSST's structure. You've heard corrections, police, 911, parole and probation. Those are all separate certification levels that we provide, as well as the training. This would create, if you will, a new category in addition to those. This would most likely fit best under a police policy committee because of the peace officer status. And why I share that is because this statute and moving this forward is cradle to grave oversight by DPSST from the date of employment till that agent leaves OLCC afterwards, so they would be decertified just like a police officer, corrections officer is, in addition to the training components been discussed. It's a public policy discussion that this group will work through, and we're willing to work with you through that. And with that, we'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative
Schaffer. There's certain physical standards, I imagine, of a police officer has to meet. Would this, I don't know what an OLC and C Spector, I don't know what the physical demand is on this job. I certainly wouldn't want to pass something and have them lose their job if they couldn't run around the building five times with a bag of Sacrete on their shoulder that weighed 90 pounds. Is that part of this? Is that, what's going on here?
Co-chair Representative Schaffler, currently we don't have the answer to the physical ability part. As been discussed, we have provided training to OLCC, but that was a custom program that we designed in partnership that now, as we move to this new level, we will validate what the training is required for that. So we will address the physical demands, if you will, for that program, what the employment standard is, because we have to validate that we don't want a person injured in the training that we provide, and we want to make sure it's realistic training. But as far as if there's going to be a physical abilities test, we really haven't gotten to that level. But we have to be able to, at the end of the day, legally defend what we're teaching, because if these agents, heaven forbid, ever go to a trial and they say, what did you get in your academy class, we stand behind that with the curriculum saying this is legally defensible training that you've received.
I mean, we have a gentleman here who's done it 26 years and he's in good shape. There may be somebody out there that's done it 20 years and ain't in great shape, but all they have to do is walk in with their briefcase and their clipboard. I don't want that person losing their job as a result of whatever we do here.
Chair Barker and Representative Schaffler, as a point of clarification, the medical standards that our agency has developed, are those for entry into the profession? There are not current maintenance standards that would follow them through their career. That's their employer's discretion.
They have to be able to carry a six-pack around the building. any further questions?
Is that all they're carrying around, Mr. Chair?
Okay. Thank you, panel. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2704. And we'll open a work session on House Bill 2688. Council, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2688 was heard on February the 15th. It's the measure that clarifies cross-reference provisions regarding designation of urban reserves. That cross-reference was discussed at the last hearing. A dash one amendment make a technical adjustment. Rather than having the two subsections A and B, it simply puts both of the relevant cross-reference statutes into the same sentence. There is no fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and no subsequent referral.
And do we need to move the amendments? They're already done.
Would have to make a motion to adopt the amendments and then make a motion to move the bill, if that's what the chair.
Okay, make a motion. Make a motion to adopt the amendments. The dash ones and twos.
Just the dash ones.
Dash one.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the amendments for House Bill 2688, the -1 amendments.
Thank you. Representative Hicks moves the House Bill 2688-1 amendments. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Open the work session is open. Call for a vote on the bill.
We have to
motion on the bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move. Okay. I move House Bill 2688 as amended for the pass recommendation.
Representative Shoffman moves House Bill 2688 as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Tomei.
Thank you. I'm afraid I'm going to be expressing my ignorance here. I didn't see the agenda until before I came in, so actually I wasn't prepared. Can anybody help me remember what the testimony we had on this?
Mr. Chair, Johnson, Representative Tomei, this is the cross-reference section. There was some confusion about cities over 25,000 and urban reserve designations and cities smaller, and it's considered a technical amendment. There was one person who testified, Carmen Bender, I believe, about the fix being a housekeeping and technical matter, and there was no objection or opposition, I mean.
Mr. Chair, this is not my area, but just for, in case some judge is listening, it's 2,500, not 25,000. So, I've looked at it, and I've looked at the reference statutes, and it is confusing. I think this is just a technical fix.
Okay.
Because already this is the requirement, but, you know, I can see a lawyer getting confused.
Right. And reading two things. And me too. Thank you.
Sure. Okay.
Yes.
Will this bill put Oregonians back to work?
I would hope so. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Whitmer.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Excuse me.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye.
Motion carried. And we'd like to carry that on the floor, carry that bill. Yeah.
We could go to consent, Helen.
No?
we could.
Then I think the good representative from Albany needs to carry this, and I will have a passel of questions for him on the floor.
After we put some non-controversial bills on the consent calendar the other day, I had complaints from members who were saying, this looks more detailed, I want to ask questions about it, don't run those out. So we will not run out consent bills unless they're so minor that somebody might have a question, so we'll allow that. Probably nobody will, but Representative Hicks will be a carrier. And adjourned.